Welcome to Genius Boy Live On Demand Radio, Episode 6. In this episode, labeled as our Year in Review show, it's not really. We'll talk about Parker Lewis Can't Lose, and maybe some wrestling, and stuff we liked. And I don't know, just listen, it's good.
So I think this is Episode 6, and the deal is that actually Ryan and I are together in the same room for the first time in Genius Boy Live On Demand Radio podcast history.
Woo!
And we'll probably only record one of these because then you have to go back to California.
Right. But it is our 2007 Year in Review special.
We'll add sound effects to that. Make it sound
cool. I think that was good enough. That was good.
So we don't really have a lot of topics planned out besides the best and worst of 2007, but we do want to talk about this theory you have about how comic books are 10 years behind movies.
Right, and it's a theory I've spent a long time thinking about. What happened is earlier today, you had mentioned that the worst Lobo signified everything that was wrong with the 90s, because he started out with some ironic commentary on action films and then became just a straightforward action kind of comic book all about big guns.
Yeah, he just wanted to frag everything.
Right.
I don't know how he originally appeared, because I didn't read his Omega Men first appearance, but I remember when Giffen really took off with the character, he did the Lobo miniseries, then the Lobo's Back, and with Simon Bisley, and that was clearly a parody of action comics and action movies. And then in the 90s, he just became like a cool gun-toting guy, but everybody was a gun-toting guy. And so your point is what?
And I said, well, that sounds like 80s movies, because there was no irony, and everything was just big and shiny, like a Bruckheimer film. And that was my theory. I guess we just ran with it. That one offhand comment became a theory.
Well,
like, how most theories start.
I think that's how Christianity started.
Evolution, Christianity.
I'm pretty sure the origin of Christianity is that
Marxism.
Someone wrote a miniseries, a four-issue series, and they just really they ran into the ground and just kept taking it seriously.
Yeah, and they said, wow, this is really about events like 80 years ago. You guys are a little behind the times. Let's go with it.
But let's go with it. Okay, so if comic books are 10 years behind movies,
right?
Let's start with the early comic books then. So the Golden Age of comics, you know, roughly starts in 1938 with Superman Action Comics number one.
I mean, and obviously, who did he fight? Mostly gangsters.
He fought gangsters, and when were the gangster movies made?
Blackface, silent film stars.
Yeah, I don't have those issues. Oh. Because
Most gangster films were made in the early 30s.
I think they recolored those when they came out in the archives.
Let's not throw around the term color. That one.
Then if gangster movies came out in the 30s.
Early 30s.
So he's like 7 years behind the times. Or
let's just roll round up to 10. So it's like 10 years behind motion pictures. So and then in the 40s.
In the 40s you had the Justice Society, you had, you know, the Flash, you had the Golden Age Green Lantern. There wasn't a lot of late 40s comic books, but it was basically superheroes versus Nazis.
Right, which was the early 40s. So again, so like 7 years. Their original comic books were 7 years behind motion pictures.
Right. That's wrong, but it's okay. We'll keep going.
Whatever. And then in the 50s.
In the 50s, you have the EC comics. You have the crime, you know, shock suspense stories. You've read. You actually read
right,
EC
which
comics.
Were like film noirs of the 40s.
And then the
a
60s.
Darker Edge.
You have the Silver Age, which is a lot of sci-fi stuff.
Like 50s films.
Mm-hmm. You also have the Underground comics, which I think the Underground comics were very similar to sort of the Easy Rider mentality, though. So I think we're only talking about mainstream comics.
Anything that doesn't fit our theory should be thrown out and excluded.
Okay, so Underground comics didn't exist in the 60s.
Did not. They mostly parodied the ideas of 50s films.
Okay, so that's probably not true either, but we're going to go with that. And then, so 70s comics were mostly
big, glossy behemoths that were terrible.
There were some of those. But there was also the stuff that was influenced by the exploitation cinema of the 70s. So how does that work? Iron Fist, Ghost Rider.
We're just going to ignore those.
Master Kung Fu.
Just going to ignore them.
Those don't exist either?
Did not. They were not pop. They were not significant enough to be included in the theory.
Well, 80s comics fit because you have stuff like Watchmen, Dark Knight Returns.
Frank Miller's Daredevil.
Is, in your mind,
like the 70s, auteur-driven, very serious, small films, you know, really introspective films that were like genre-bending, that sort of thing.
Right. That does fit, except for I wouldn't call either Dark Knight Returns or Watchmen small, but they are certainly auteur-driven drama.
Metafictional, dark. In a way.
They're certainly playing with form.
Yes.
And then the 90s comics were big action, lots of guns, lots of pouches.
Like your 80s movies.
Like Commando has a lot of pouches and guns.
And a lot of machetes.
And so if that's true, then the movies in this decade of the 2000s must be ironic.
Driven by irony.
And self-referential.
Absolutely.
Maybe dark.
Very dark. Very independent feeling. I'm sure this is the decade of independent comic books.
Maybe. Well, look at all the mainstream creators. All the guys at Marvel. You have Bendis, Quesada. Where did they all start off? They really made their mark in the independents. And same thing at DC. No, actually, it's not true at all at DC. So it doesn't apply.
Again, we're going to ignore that. We're going to say, actually, you know what? As far as I know, most of the DC comic creators actually did start as independent, gritty, self-financed kind of comic book guys.
Well, let's go through the roster. You have Grant Morrison.
Right.
He started off in Scotland.
Right, which is gritty and small and dirty.
You have Jeff Johns, who started off in Hollywood.
Right, gritty, small. Early in this decade, you wouldn't want to go there. It's a terrible place. Now it's very nice. Come visit.
You have Mark Waid, who obviously started out as a fan. He was doing indexes and stuff like that.
Right, and an index is like a really independent comic book that no one would read.
Interesting. And then...
And it's what's more self-referential than an index?
I don't really know of any other DC writers besides that, other than pretty much every other DC writer I read. So we'll assume that they're all independent then. So
100%.
At the end of the day, we've conclusively proven that movies are 10 years ahead of comic books. And therefore, let's take it to the next extreme. If comic books are published in the next decade...
Say the comic books of 2017...
Will be what?
Will be about giant robots from outer space that transform into trucks or ships and sequels. Look for
Watchmen 3. I've never, ever seen a comic book sequel. So,
no.
I don't think comic books have the innate potential to sequelize because
they're
mostly one and done, and then that's it. Don't really...
No, it's a look out, new format coming.
So
maybe you'll see Watchmen 2, Electric Watchmen Alu.
You think we could invest in that somehow? Like we could put our money in comic book sequel properties that are going to grow, something involving robots or trucks?
Most of my money is tied up in litigation right now.
Is that based on the Bipod scandal?
I can't really say. Most of those records are or will be sealed.
All right, our next segment is entitled Corindemic Poetry or Parker Lewis Can't Lose Episode.
Yes.
Because, of course, Corindemic, a.k.a. Corkynemic, was the star of the 80s TV show Parker Lewis Can't Lose.
90s TV show.
Was it in the 90s?
I'm pretty sure.
See, we talked about this earlier, and it's hard for me to believe that was in the 90s, because why would I have watched it in the 90s?
You were, I don't know, like 17?
It was before the internet, so.
We got four channels at that point in our home. You didn't have much choice.
That's true. I forgot I was still a teenager.
It was probably on after The Simpsons at some point.
Okay, so here I'm going to read, not the entire thing, but I'm going to read a few lines of either a poem written by Corindemic, who's now an adult. He's like 35 now.
And a noted poet, from what I'm told.
We'll talk about that later. I'm going to read a few lines from his poetry, or it could be an episode guide. You tell me which one's which. Ready?
Okay.
Larry's college football scholarship is in jeopardy. When it is discovered, he can't add.
I'm going to say that is a Parker Lewis Can't Lose episode summary.
You're right. And who's Larry?
Larry Kubiak. Abraham Ben-Ruby.
And it was pretty sad that he couldn't actually add, because in high school, I could see not being able to do calculus, but
no.
Adding is relatively easy.
But he could subtract with the best of them.
Yeah, well, I think that's where a guy's name Kubiak from was his subtraction skills.
I think it was his last character's last name.
Okay, here we go. The Buds use the school's pirate radio station to unwittingly turn everyone against them. Poem or episode?
I want to say poem, but I'm going to go with episode.
Yeah, it's an episode.
Okay, good.
The Buds refers to...
The Buddies.
The Buddies, Parker Lewis, and the other guys who I have no idea what their name is.
I remember Timothy Stack played his father.
Was there a Mikey or a Mickey?
There was another man.
A boy.
Man boy.
Yeah. Here's some more.
He was a man who played a boy, as most TV shows do.
I'm so cool, fool. Burn, I can't even read this, seriously. I'm so cool, fool.
I'm going to guess this is not an episode summary.
Burn it away. Why be cool when you can be intelligent and caring and filled with love for all mankind?
I'm going to say that's a poem and a pretty good one. I've only now...
Now, keep in mind, it's only a part of something larger.
That's the first poem I've ever heard. So I don't have much of a frame of reference, but that one sounded pretty good.
It is a poem, but it could also be an episode about how Parker Lewis is now a 35-year-old Scientologist who can't really get work. Possible.
Could
Here's be. Another.
Is this but a, he seems to be pretty cool.
Corindemic poem or Parker Lewis Can't Lose episode.
Okay.
Find yourself in that sweet harmony when the mind is silent and all thoughts burned away by the heat.
Poem.
You're right, it's a poem.
This game isn't that hard, honestly.
At the mall, Parker searches for his elusive dream girl. Jenny searches for a job. And Musso tries to stop spending money.
Now, this could be a tricky one because Parker is in it. So it's like he threw me off, but I'm going to go with my gut and say poem.
You're wrong. It is an episode, after all.
Did it take place at the mall?
I'm pretty sure it did because that's why it says at the mall. Here's one more part. A fresh water stream boiling gently from beneath the ground. Fresh and cool. Real cool. Not that fake facade personified, or rather deified, by your own mental trappings.
I'm going to say that's a poem. And I'm going to say how impressed I am. Most people who are writers, especially poets, because you have so few words to convey emotions and ideas and symbolism and whatnot, try to use many words, many adverbs, many adjectives, maybe descriptive words. But Corindemic has chosen to use cool.
Not only that.
Many times in many, many poems. And, I mean, what's a better adjective than cool? Like, everyone knows what you're talking about. Like, that's, for instance, that's a cool car. You know that's a cool car. There's no other word necessary.
Right. And the word cool has double meaning because it means cool. And right. It also means, like, chilly.
Right, because it references the boiling freshwater.
Right, because obviously boiling out of the ground implies coolness.
Right. I don't think he knows what words mean.
Well, he's now a celebrated poet. Because here's why we're playing this game. And I told you this before.
Oh, I thought I could win money.
There's no prize. There's no.
I was
promised. Just like Corindemic's life, there's no ultimate reward other than obscurity. But he doesn't have obscurity, and here's why, because I told you this already, but... Obviously, you guys listening have no idea because you have better things to do than go on the internet all the time and look up stuff.
Clearly.
But if you go to, just Google Parker Lewis Bud Bundy. Just Google that because you'll find a little YouTube clip about Parker Lewis and Bud Bundy, David Faustino and Corindemic. And they're in this, I guess it's some kind of instructional video advertisement for the guy who wrote that book, The Game, which is the book... That's how to pick up girls. And it was that show. It was the show this summer. The pickup artist. It's like that kind of technique.
Right.
You go around and you say something slightly insulting. And you basically have, there's these techniques that you can use. And you can pick up really hot girls who are way above you. And this whole deal. Anyway.
Because generally they're insecure.
So some of this guy obviously must have paid money to these two guys. Bud Mundy and Parker Lewis. Who are now, what, 35, 40? And so they're out. And they're trying to pick up girls. And the bet is that Bud Bundy, wearing a dildo on his head, can pick up more girls than Parker Lewis, even though Parker Lewis is far more handsome and tall than Bud Bundy. And of course, because it's a promo for this guy's book, Bud Bundy is more successful. Even with a dildo on his head, he gets like three girls' phone numbers on Hollywood Boulevard or whatever random street they're picking up hookers on, than Parker Lewis. And, you know, it's pretty clear that Bud Bundy, even if it was real, like it says it's real, says, oh, this is not scripted. Bud Bundy would probably pick up more girls than Parker Lewis just because people recognize him. He looks the same as Bud Bundy, and they're like, oh, you're Bud Bundy. And they'll probably give him a fake phone number, but they'll probably talk to him. So I did a little more research on Corindemic because I'm like, really? Corindemic? What's he up to? And he has a website. I think it's corindemic.com probably. And on there, I read his biography. In his biography, he's really, really proud of his poetry.
He calls it very cool.
So I had to read some of his poetry, And now I'm an English teacher, so I read poetry all the time. And it sounded a lot like bad, bad high school poetry. And so I was like, wow, okay, he's a bad high school poet, but he's proud of it. And he's sort of a semi-famous person, or was. And he's actually including his poetry on his website, so he must be proud of it. And then also in his biography, he talks about how proud he is that he was chosen to be in a book called The Best Poets of the Year 2000. And as I read it, I was like, that's not a real book. There's no way. So I did a little more digging on the internet, and I Googled it. I looked around. First of all, that title doesn't exist. There's actually it's a book called The Best Poems of the Year 2000. And that's what he's referring to. It's like, he talks about that in another interview as the title. And he actually says in an interview, and I think it's for a Stargate appearance, because he played a character in Stargate, he talks about how proud he is. He's like, I always thought my poetry was good, but it's glad to be finally recognized by somebody else. Because he was published in this book, The Best Poets, Best Poems of the Year 2000.
And best was not in quotation marks. It wasn't
ironic. No, he thought it was a real book. So I looked it up, and turns out that it is a book, and he was in it, and it was published by the International Library of Poetry.
Oh, it's prestigious.
Which I investigated more about, and sure, and I was pretty sure this was the case, because being a high school teacher, I've seen this scam happen. The International Library of Poetry is not a real organization. Well, it is, but it's a profitable organization that runs the website poetry.com. And what you do is you submit your poem, and you automatically get awarded publication as long as it's something like 20 lines or less, or 40 lines or less, whatever the minimum requirement is, maximum requirement. And then they charge you like $60 for your copy of the book. But they tell you you've been selected. And I know this because I've had high school students who've been so proud of being selected, and then I have to tell them it's a scam because I've looked into this. And actually Barbara Walters did a 2020 special on this very scam, where they had an entire third grade class submit poems, and they all were selected. It says, congratulations, you've been chosen to be an elite member of the best poet of the year, whatever. And they were all published, too, in whatever year edition of that book by the International Library of Poetry. So it's an obvious scam. He must have paid money to be published in that book. And I can't believe that he would fall for that as an adult, and not only fall for it, but brag about it and brag about how other people appreciate his poetry and that he's not the only one. And I feel sad for him, too. I feel a little sad.
Well, he is an actor, and I live in Los Angeles, and I know many actors. I'm surrounded by them.
You should cast him.
And you have to realize they're just like you and I. They're just actors, are just like everyday people, only 19 to 35% dumber. They're not the brightest people on earth. They're often naive, so this explains a lot of it.
But if you wrote a poem that was, okay, it was mediocre, and you submitted it to a place called poetry.com.
Right.
Which is where he must have submitted it. And then they said, you've been selected to be published in this book. And if you want to copy the book, it costs $60. Yes. Wouldn't you be a little skeptical? Because no poetry book would cost $60. And anybody who actually thinks you're a good writer would not ask you to pay money to be in the book. They would either pay you or at least give you a free copy.
Right. I'd only fall for that scam 2 or 3 times.
And Parker Lewis fell for it just once. So I guess
turns out Parker Lewis can lose.
Yeah, that was the title of every article about this. So
You see how my voice went up in the end there? That was the way we could have ended the segment. Was a little tag or button, as they call it.
I already read about that in your
show. And it's Parker Lewis can lose.
I bumped into Lainey Rose. Do you know Lainey Rose?
No.
Local guy, he is actually contributing to a book I'm working on, and I knew him when we were kids. We actually played soccer together when we were about 10, and we kind of didn't really know each other anytime between then and now, but we reunited in the comic book store.
It's all fascinating.
Comic book stores are great places to make friends and really keep them.
Right.
And girls, meet girls, and boys and girls.
More boys. Many, many more men.
But Lainey Rose is a cool guy. He published a novel. It's called The Fae Princes. No, Tapestry. He wrote a novel called Tapestry. It's about some Fae Princes. I don't know. I didn't read it. But I'm sure it's good. It's big. It's thick. And so he's a writer and a smart guy, and I respect his opinion. And he reads my blog, and he's like, I have to ask you a question. And I was reading your blog. I was just goofing around, and I saw that under your profile, where it lists your favorite movies, Grindhouse is one of your favorite movies. And now, you know what, and I didn't say this to him, but I mean, honestly, probably Grindhouse isn't one of my favorite movies ever, but I probably made up that profile page after I'd seen Grindhouse, like later that week.
Right.
So it was fresh in my mind. But I still, I think I could defend Grindhouse as a really good entertaining movie, and I enjoyed it. So I just want to talk about Grindhouse a little bit, because he hated it. He absolutely hated it. And he could not understand how anybody could possibly, even as a rash decision, list that under any sort of quality or any sort of best movies or whatever. What did you actually see Grindhouse?
I saw Grindhouse. I enjoyed
it. Did you see it in the theater?
I saw it in the theater. Yes, I did. It was one of the few films I saw in the theater this year. I really liked it. I enjoyed, I thought it was really, really fun for like an, it had like an 80s zombie movie kind of feel. I usually don't like gory movies, but it was pretty cool. It was fun. It was Rodriguez's most fun film. It reminded me a lot of the film, the Dan O'Bannon film, Return of the Living Dead.
Just I haven't seen that.
I felt like a, you know, like a fun direct-to-video kind of 80s movie, like didn't take itself too seriously. It was very, very tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, a lot of fun, and went by quickly and had some good actors and some good humor, and I liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Because it was definitely the most fun experience I've had in the theater for several years. Like, I can't remember going to a theater and having that much fun right. the entire time. And I think it does, I mean, it hits kind of a roadblock when you get to Planet Terror because, after Planet Terror, when you watch Planet Terror and you're watching all the fake trailers and...
What do you mean? I'm sorry?
And then you get to Death Proof.
What do you mean after Planet Terror?
Oh, you didn't see the second half? Grindhouse is two movies.
Why would it be two movies?
It was a Grindhouse double feature. It was a fake trailer for Machete, and then it was Planet Terror, which was Robert Rodriguez.
Why would there be a fake trailer?
And then there was these more fake trailers, like one was by Eli Roth, and one was by the guys from Shaun of the Dead, and then...
No.
Then there was a movie called... Death Proof. Death Proof was about Kurt Russell driving a car.
This is not the movie I saw, because Rose McGowan blows up a zombie with her machine gun leg, and the movie ends. End of movie, I left theater.
No, there's a whole other movie after that.
You're kidding me.
Didn't you read anything about it before you went to see it?
No. It was Grindhouse. Robert Rodriguez, Planet Terror, Grindhouse.
Why would it be called Grindhouse and Planet Terror? I would have two names.
I don't know. I just thought it was a dumb name. Like... You know, they name movies dumb all the time. Why is it called Pirates of the Caribbean 3 at World's End? Like, they're arbitrary names.
So, would you say that knowing what you know now, does that make Grindhouse better or worse? Because you missed half.
Well, I'm upset. I'm angry, actually.
Who are you angry at?
You, for one.
I wasn't with you.
You could have told me. You could have said, hey, by the way, when you see it, stick, you know, it's like when you see a movie, and, you know, there's a funny bit at the end of the credits, like they have the hilarious outtakes, or there's some, like, you know, capper at the end of the credits, and you tell your buddy, hey, you know, stick around, because there's something funny after the credits. You could have said, hey, Ryan, stick around. There's a whole other goddamn movie after the credits. I would have liked to see that. Well, did Rodriguez make the second movie?
Actually, it was Quentin Tarantino.
You know, he's, like, my favorite filmmaker.
Yeah, that's why I thought you would have known, because you probably have read the internet. And the internet was talking about it. Harry Knowles was talking about it on the internet.
I don't read that site.
Did you see the TV ads?
Yeah, they said Grindhouse. Then they showed
Kurt Russell. The poster has...
Yeah, no, I thought... Well,
the poster has a car. There was no car with the skull.
Well, I thought it was one of those deals where they had it, and, you know, because when they edit the trailers, it's frequently long before the movie comes out. So it's like, remember Dirty Rotten Scoundrels? There's a whole scene where Michael Caine and Steve Martin are walking down the pier and they push the guy into the water. Yes. And everyone wants to see the movie, wait and see that scene, but it wasn't in the movie because it was just the trailer. I thought the Kurt Russell stuff was just for the trailer. And I was like, oh, well, that's weird. Kurt Russell must have got cut out.
Right, but I went to see Dirty Rotten Scoundrels because Steve Martin almost poked himself in the eye with a fork.
But you didn't know that until...
That was in the trailer also.
I don't know.
Ruprecht.
That was a completely different thing. There was a whole second movie with Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
And a car.
Death Proof. His car was Death Proof.
That sounds pretty cool.
You should see it. They have it on DVD. But you can't actually recapture the experience because...
No, I can't.
They didn't include all the fake trailers, so you can't watch just Planet Terror and then Death Proof and simulate the experience because, first of all, you're not in the theater. And second of all, you miss out on the fake trailers in between and the fake little ads for the Chicken Shack or whatever it's called. You missed all that stuff.
Yeah.
You should write a letter.
To whom? What's this guy? The guy
Miramax Brothers?
Who's your friend who wrote the book about the quill? I'll write him a letter and say, like, well, the half I saw was good.
I don't think it's about a quill. It was a tapestry.
Whatever.
Tapestry is a metaphor for the melting pot of America. Except, like, medieval times. When medieval America.
Oh, that'd be an interesting movie. about medieval America.
Well, we didn't really have
John Adams cars. And Ben Franklin with like a giant axe.
That would be good.
And like George Washington stirring a bubbling cauldron.
I think your timeline's off because I don't think that was medieval America was before that. Medieval America was like before history. So
well, maybe when I make
we don't have any records of what Americans were doing. We just know all of a sudden that like they started the Declaration of Independence, and so we don't have a lot of records before that. So medieval America, it was like, you know, knights in shining armor, except we don't have those legends are all lost.
Well, we don't know that these men weren't alive in that time, and they just sealed the records. Maybe they made their own silly double book, and people didn't read the second half of the book because they thought it was over. You know?
But there's like 200 pages left, so you'd know it wasn't over. You would keep going. You don't stop in the middle of a book when the chapter ends, even though there's still like a big thick chunk left. You don't stop and say, oh, it must be over because there's a blank page here.
Yeah, you do.
You look and see. Just like in the movies.
Have you met anyone? You've read the Bible, right?
Sure, I've read the Bible. Right. I've read dozens of Bibles.
The Bible is made up of two parts, the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, I have friends who are Jews. They stop reading halfway through. They read the first part. They don't like the sequel. They read the first part only.
I think they buy a special Bible that's cut in half. So I don't even know if it has a back cover.
Oh.
So that's why they stop. Because they don't actually have anything else to read.
And there's other people.
I believe it's called the Halfsie Bible.
Some people, the Mormons, they have the second half, but they have a different version of it. It's like it's like Walking Tall, the Rock movie. Like it's like their version of the new Bible. Like a remake.
Yeah, and their Bible.
It involves Jesus in Utah.
It was printed on giant golden plates, so it's hard to read, it's hard to carry around. So I think they photocopied it and made it smaller. They folded it up. Yeah.
So they really made two movies, and they released them as one movie.
Yeah.
How was this a good idea?
It made a ton of money at the box office. It was like number one of the year.
Nope.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. If you look it up on Joe Blow's Movies Release.net. Nope.
Quentin Tarantino made a movie and I didn't see it this year.
Yeah. It was at Cannes. Did you go to Cannes?
No.
Oh, no? Did you go to Canada?
No. Yes. No. Not this year.
Not this year?
No.
Did you go to Japan?
Yes.
Did they have it over there? Did they have extended cut?
No, I bought the Kill Bill extended cut there.
So you've seen
Which was one movie they released in two parts.
Right.
Which makes more sense because then you... I don't understand this.
They've never done it before and they might never do it again because I think they probably received a lot of hate mail from people who walked down. So, I think we should probably move on.
Yeah, we should.
Maybe we should go take a walk. Call.
Yeah. Do you have both parts here?
Yeah, I do. I have them on the DVD.
Okay, well, maybe I should watch both parts.
All right. Maybe we can just watch and do commentary.
Okay.
So let's pop it in.
All right.
So we lost all of our commentary footage. We recorded 4 hours of Grindhouse, Planet Terror, and Death Proof commentary, and we lost it all.
But yeah.
You just watched the whole thing.
So I've seen Death Proof. I've actually sat through the second movie. And yeah, it's two movies.
Right, right. You see, did you see that movie start, and then you walked out and you thought that was part of the credits?
I had no idea what was going on.
So what do you think now that you've seen the whole thing? Now that you've seen Planet Terror and Death Proof?
I like Death Proof more than Planet Terror.
Really?
You know, I mean, despite the fact that it's a lot of chicks talking and it's annoying. At the end, you know, it's really slow in the beginning and these women are really obnoxious and you want to kill them. And then Kurt Russell's really cool and then the whole thing feels like people hanging out and then it builds and builds and builds and builds. And then at the end, when Zoe Bell is on the hood of that car, you think she's going to die, and you really, really care, and I just think it's great storytelling. You know, I think it's drama builds at the end, and then when Kurt Russell gets his, it's really great. I think Tarantino's a fantastic filmmaker, and I really liked it.
So I like that he didn't use CGI for any of that stuff. Like, you know Zoe Bell's on the car.
Right, yeah.
And there's so many movies now where all the action sequences are just explosion CGI, so phony.
And the open shutter shaky cam.
The shaky cam stuff.
Where you can't even tell what's going on half the time.
Or even just, like, I like the slow motion stuff, but enough. Enough of the slow motion and explosions. And Quentin Tarantino doesn't use any of that, but he's able to have fantastic action sequences.
No.
I don't like the first act, I guess, of the movie, because the dialogue doesn't mean anything, and also Eli Roth annoys me. So I have a problem with that part. But I think the second half of Death Proof is really good. It's think it's up there with a lot of the Quentin Tarantino peaks. And as I was telling you, like, you can't ignore anything Quentin Tarantino does, because what he does affects the culture for the rest of the decade. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Pulp Fiction changed cinema, changed
absolutely
the priorities of certain genres. And same thing with Kill Bill. Kill Bill all of a sudden refocused the attention to kung fu movies. And you point out the music is always influential. Every TV commercial for the next 6 months or a year uses the same commercials, the same music from Quentin Tarantino movies. And it's just so important. So, are you still mad? Are you happy now?
I mean, you can't go back in time and you can't change what you did. That's the defense I've used in every trial I've ever had. I'm okay. I feel okay now. I've seen the movie. I feel much better. And apparently it's a director's cut, so it's more than I could have seen in the theater.
Yeah, there's that extended sequence at the Quickie Mart Place thing, and the black and white, and then there's also more the lap dance.
The lap dance with
the girl that's got the pot belly.
And the deformed girl with the pot belly, yeah.
The girl who's got the funny face, who's kind of ugly and looks...
God bless her. God bless her that she would have that facial deformity and decide to become an actress.
Well...
Brave. She's brave.
I think that's why Quentin
cast her. That was awful. That was a little low. I apologize. Anonymous girl who's not attractive.
Well, it's Vanessa Ferlito.
So. Oh. I don't
know. If you look her up on the internet, you'll see.
She's done what else?
I don't know. She should date Cord Nemec because he is single. I think
he could probably write a poem about her. Maybe call
her. Cord Nemec is actually married. He's married with kids, and he's out there trying to pick up chicks with Dildo Bud Bundy.
That thing you watch could have been scripted.
Yeah, he is a professional actor.
I just did air quotes, like you could see it on the podcast.
You did air quotes, so we should add an air quote sound effect.
Wah, wah.
Yeah, I'll go back and add that in every time
you use air quotes. And also delete that sound effect that I just made.
But I'm afraid if I put that in every time you use air quotes, it'll be a lot of that.
It would be.
Like, use air
quotes. Nonstop. Yeah. You know what I mean? Tired of overpriced mall calendars? Don't be mauled by high calendar prices again. Don't let the mall take advantage of your wallet. Mall, I'm saying, is that there's a better choice. HalsIrregularCalendar.net/cal_pricesave.htm. At HalsIrregularCalendar.net/cal_pricesave.htm, you'll find the best selection of 11-month calendars, 29-day calendars, even calendars without Mondays. Who likes Mondays anyway? I sure don't. Skip it at Hal's. Whatever your calendar needs, we're sure you'll find something near that at Hal's. Remember, it's HalsIrregularCalendar.net/cal_pricesave.htm. Drop that last L for savings.
That also sounds fake.
Drop that last L for lower prices sounds better.
Drop that last L for
savings. I don't think this is an actual website.
Let me see that copy here. Was this faxed to us?
It was actually an email.
It says, tired of overpriced mall calendars, and it's, you know, all caps mall. And then it's don't be mauled is also spelled like the shopping mall.
Like mall.
And then don't let the mall, as in like them all, but it's spelled mall. And it's like mall, I'm saying, as if the shopping mall is the same as mall, I'm saying.
Yeah, mall.
So do you think, I mean, do those puns come across when you just hear it? Because are we supposed to post this on our website too?
Is it possible that Cord Nemec wrote this?
Oh, man. Plus, why would you want an irregular calendar? The whole purpose of a calendar is that you want to know when certain things are going to happen. Like, oh, I'm going to write my dentist appointment. You're like, oh, crap, this calendar doesn't have Mondays. And if it doesn't have Mondays, doesn't that mess up every other day for the rest of the month?
I would think so.
So
maybe you do like a little half, like when there's 31 days in a month, a little half thing on every Tuesday and write the top half for Monday and the bottom half for Tuesday.
Actually, that wouldn't be that hard. But it's also like not the catchiest website. Hal's Irregular Calendar. Hal's. It's Hal. HalsIrregularCalendar.net/cal_pricesave.htm. Really, that's their website? Is that what the title of their website is also? Do they actually have the cal_pricesave.htm as, do you have to search for that when you type it into Google? How did you contact these guys?
You should hear their jingle. Because it's long, and it's not catchy.
So this is really the focus of the show. I don't know if we're going to have enough time to go through it, but it's the year in review.
2007. Year in review.
2007.
2007. Radio.
And podcast, Genius Boy Live Radio, year in review, podcast on demand. 2007. Episode. Well, this is our first year in review show.
Our first annual.
I would say 2000. We picked a good year to review.
We did. We certainly did.
I think 2000. No, not just in comic books, but also in movies. I don't know about TV because I don't really watch much TV. I don't really know that much about music either. But I would say in movies and comic books, 2007 was one of the best years in the past year. Maybe the best year.
Perhaps.
So you just name something that would be – let's start with things that we thought were crappy. What was something – it's year in review, so we do think it's a good year, both in movies and in comic books. But even though it was a good year, there were some low points. So what was something particularly bad and horrible and made your eyes bleed in 2007?
The film Harsh Times. Was that this year or last year? I don't even know.
I don't even know.
But I watched it this year. Was
Harsh Times like a Fox TV show from the 90s?
It was, but Harsh Times with Christian Bale and Freddie Rodriguez.
Why did you watch that?
I heard it was good. Yeah. And it was by David Goyer, what's the guy's name?
David Mamet?
No, the guy who wrote Training Day, and he's going to remake The Wild Bunch. Google search on Wild Bunch remake, and this guy. The film Harsh Times about two buddies and who are from LA, blah, blah, blah. It's terrible. It's just about dumb, dumb people. It's like someone who watched Mean Streets and said, I'd like to make that movie, but instead of having compelling characters and an interesting story, I'm just going to have dumb guys and have them do drugs and shoot people.
Is it cops?
Oh, it's terrible.
Are they gangsters?
They want to be. It's a story of the guy. He's an Iraq war vet, and he wants to be a cop, but he fails their psychiatric exam, and he is going to go into the Homeland Security, and it's just ridiculous, and it's so bad. And Eva Longoria is in it. Oh, man, it's terrible.
Was it even released in theaters?
Yeah.
So that would be your worst of 2007?
Off the top of my head, yeah.
I didn't see a lot that I hated as far as movies in 2007, but I think B Movie was pretty bad. B Movie would be up because B Movie turned out to be a courtroom drama,
really,
for kids. Yeah,
what's the deal with courtrooms?
Right.
There was lots of that.
It was a lot of that, yeah. And there was some funny stuff about how bees have a short lifespan. They have to pick really quickly and go through their whole career choices and education in like a day. And I get that, and it was kind of funny because Jerry Seinfeld was good at his delivery. The animation was nice. But then halfway through the movie, it turns into a courtroom drama where the bees are trying to sue humans for using honey. And they try to make jokes out of it. They have, like, Ray Liotta brand honey, and that's funny. And then Ray Liotta appears on the witness stand as, like, one of the major honey distributors in the country. But it's still just half an hour of a courtroom battle about whether or not humans have a right to use honey. And that's not interesting for kids, and it's a kids' movie, and there's not anything substantial in it for adults. So, what's the point?
Actually, written by bees?
I don't know. I didn't look it up. I don't know the writer of Training Day or the writer of B Movie. Maybe they're the same person, for all I know. So, I don't say that's not the worst movie I've ever seen, but it's probably one of the most disappointing movies of 2007 because I didn't expect it to be a dull courtroom drama targeted at kids. Very strange. Very strange choice. How about a best of? Give me something, anything, any sort of medium that you would say would be a best of 2007.
Well, sticking with film, the best thing I've seen this year is probably No Country for Old Men.
Yes, we saw that together.
Which is also probably the best book I've read this year, which came out years ago, but I read it this year.
I also read it this year. I read it this summer.
It was very good. And the movie, that's the thing is, it would have been really interesting to see the movie not having read the book, because the movie is an amazingly faithful adaptation of the book and captures not only the plot and the characters, but the tone of it so very well, which is the most difficult thing for a book to do is to capture, for a film to do is capture the tone of a book, and it captures it so well. But there's so many twists—I mean, not twists and turns, but so many surprises—and you know, if you're familiar with the film, there's some setups that aren't paid off, but it's still interesting. And it would have been really nice to see the movie with fresh eyes and not know like what's going to happen and all the things that are going to happen because it's a really great movie, and it's incredibly well made.
Yeah, and also, I read a lot of reviews, and I think we talked about this before, that they said it had the typical Coen Brothers humor, Yeah. And it's like neither of us really saw that because we were just seeing it as a Cormac McCarthy adaptation.
Right.
And the novel didn't really have any humor.
No.
I mean, Cormac McCarthy has kind of this absurdist apocalyptic humor.
Right. And there's and with Tommy Lee Jones, bleakness. There's a very, very dry, sarcastic humor in his delivery.
And the Javier Bardem character is humorous in his unrelenting nature.
Right. And like in the, you laugh because so you're not terrified kind of way.
So if I hadn't read the book, maybe I would think it was funny.
Right. And also because I love the Coen brothers and I'm very, very familiar with their work. I've seen everything they've made several times and I really like their work. And I would say it's not like a Coen brothers kind of film. And you know, it's not like typical Coen. It's, you know, it's not their normal like tropes and all that kind of stuff. It's a very like dark movie. I mean, it's like Miller's Crossing is a very dark movie, but as you watch it, it's like, as you're familiar with it, it's so, so hyper stylized and so much of their stuff is hyper stylized. And this film is stylized in a way, but it's also the acting is much more realistic and much more naturalistic than their other films.
I think a lot of their other films are pastiches. Like Miller's Crossing is pastiche. It's not a parody.
Oh, yeah. All of their crime films are pastiches.
And a pastiche doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It just means that they're copying the stylistic effects of a certain writer or a certain film genre.
Yeah.
And they're playing, they're treating that with playfulness. There's not much playfulness in No Country for Old Men. There are some formal things they do, some type, you know, some kind of visual experience.
Right, they have their own visual style.
But it's not a pastiche of any other type of movie I've seen. No. It's not even a pastiche of a Western, which it is clearly a Western.
Yes.
And I wrote a review of it on Jeff Klock's blog. I wrote about how it's sort of like the ultimate 21st century Western in the way it doesn't ironically satirize the West or the genre of the Western, but it's sort of a statement about the Western. It's what the Western is now.
Right. And there's so
and it's still, the mythology is still there, and it's, so it's a mythical look at the West, but it's not a mythical look about the heroic West.
No.
Because the whole point is, No Country for Old Men, like No Country for Heroes. Like, heroes don't belong. The kind of John Wayne hero doesn't exist in that world.
And it's right, like, in terms of Western, there's so many Westerns, dating back to, since really the beginning of Westerns, that lament the loss of the West, of the you know, encroachment of civilization and how it's no longer the free country that it used to be. And so many classic Westerns are about that, from Unforgiven to Outlaw Josie Wales to The Wild Bunch is famously about that, about, you know, the loss of the Old West. And this film does it in such a naturalistic way. Like, it doesn't use like big symbols to get the story across. It uses just one man who's this deadly, who's just not even deadly, or he is deadly, but not even like he's just to be evil. He's just kind of in some ways like a more efficient man. Like, he is a walking symbol of technological progress.
Right. You know? Not that he uses any kind of fancy technology, but he just marches forward and gets the job done.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's got his own like sixth sense of humor himself.
Right.
But he's unrelenting and efficient, and that's the threat. Yeah.
And he sees things very, very clearly.
Right.
And
I like, that's why some people have actually criticized the Woody Harrelson performance, because it does seem a little out of place in that movie, because he seems like he's a little too self-assured and too gung-ho, and everybody else in the movie is not timid, but they're subdued, and they are measured in their delivery, in their look at the world. And Woody Harrelson comes charging in, and he's like, hey, y'all, how you doing?
Yeah.
And, but that's how that character, Carson Wells' character, should be, because Carson Wells thinks he knows the score.
Right,
he thinks he has the whole picture, but he actually knows nothing.
Yeah.
He doesn't understand the evil he's dealing with, even though his character is based on his braggadocio is, oh, I know what I'm dealing with, let me take care of this. And he thinks he's playing all the angles, but in fact, he's being manipulated by everybody else as well, and he ends up paying the price for it.
Right, because he's a character who's come from that world, because he's a war hero. He was like, a Green Beret colonel or a Marine colonel. And he comes from that world of death and destruction and that kind of thing, but he just, it's like a different level. It's like an exponential leap from him.
But even that world had some kind of heroism or idealism that
and some kind of parameters
that he is not ready for in No Country for Old Men, because even though the Josh Brolin character was also a veteran, it's like those characters, even though they're still relatively young, and that war only happened, you know, 8 years earlier or whatever, yeah. because the movie's supposed to take place in 1980, even they are, like, left behind. They're outdated. And so I thought that was kind of cool. So I agree that No Country for Old Men is probably my favorite movie of the year. I haven't seen There Will Be Blood yet.
No, which
but I expect that to be high on my list.
I'm very excited to see.
P.T. Anderson's one of my favorite directors.
And Dan Lee-Lewis is a phenomenal actor, and I think his performance in Gangs of New York is amazing. He's just so scary and so believable in every little thing he does, even playing a largely theatrical character. That guy's fantastic.
Well, my best of 2007, I don't know when we're going to post this podcast, but we are doing, a few other bloggers and I are doing a whole big best of comic books, you know, 10 best comic books of 2007. I've been leading up to my blog, I've been talking about like what's outside the 20. So I don't really want to talk about what's in my top 10 list because it's either on my blog already or it's going to be posted soon. And as far as movies, certainly No Country for Old Men would be up there. We did see the Walk Hard, Dewey Cox story, which I liked. I think
it's very
that
funny.
Would probably be in my top five movies of 2007 just because I haven't seen that many this year.
Would honestly. Grindhouse make your top?
Grindhouse, Walk Hard, No Country for Old Men. What else have I seen this year that was really great?
I thought
it came out earlier in the year.
Ratatouille was excellent.
I haven't seen that.
It was an excellent, excellent film.
Wasn't there something that came out in the first half of the year that was supposed to be good that would probably be in the, I don't even know.
We've got a list in front of us, which we did no preparation for this.
No, we have
we're fantastic.
But I'm sure there's
anyway, broadcasters.
But I do, I want to talk about one of my best of, which would be the comic book writer Matt Fraction. Matt Fraction is, out of all the things or people, he would be the best of 2007 for me because he's produced really interesting comic book work this year. I mean, he's currently producing Casanova, which is the best comic book Image publishes, and it might be the best comic book of the past decade as possible. Like Casanova, not just the hardcover Luxuria, which collects the first six issues, or seven, no, first seven issues, but the regular ongoing comic that's now printed in blue and white, and it's a great comic. So he does that, and that's his clearly his baby, you know, that's the thing he really pours his heart and soul into. But he also does Punisher War Journal, which has been good. I don't like the Ariel Olivetti art, and I've blogged about this, because he does use a lot of Photoshop, and he gets video game backgrounds, and in one of the recent issues, I think it was issue 12 or 13 or whatever, he just cut and pasted guns from the Doom game, and he put the guns in the character's hands, and they don't fit, you know, it's just like color forms. And so I don't like his art, but Matt Fraction has done a good job with the Punisher character. I always thought the best use of the Punisher character and the reason that Punisher didn't work for a lot of years and the reason that a Punisher movie would never really work is that the only thing interesting about Punisher is his relationship to the superheroes. He's just a regular vigilante otherwise. But if you say, oh, here's this vigilante who kills people, how does he play off of typical Marvel superheroes and how do they respond to him? That's the interesting thing. And that's what Punisher War Journal is all about. It's about his relationship in the Marvel Universe as far as, you know, in continuity and also to the act of vigilanteism that other characters are doing. So I like that. And he also, of course, has a sense of humor, as a writer Matt Fraction does. And so that makes the Punisher a little more tolerable. I haven't read a lot of Punisher lately that I've liked other than Punisher War Journal. Plus, on top of Casanova and Punisher War Journal, he also does The Order, which is the most interesting of the new superhero titles this year. The Order, the premise of The Order, you haven't read any Order issues, right?
No.
The premise of The Order, it used to be called The Champions. They couldn't call it The Champions because that was owned by the role-playing game company, right? So they couldn't call it that, even though there was the classic Champions from the 80s. The whole point of The Order is that now that the Tony Stark and those guys have won the Civil War, they're setting up a superhero team in every state, and The Order is California's super team. Mm-hmm. And so it plays on the relationship between celebrity and the media and being a hero. And it plays with those things in an interesting way.
Like West Coast Avengers.
Even more interesting than West Coast Avengers. Fraction has talked about being influenced by Shaken. And it does have a little bit of that Shaken feel because one of the main characters was a flunky for Iron Man who kind of went through the same kind of alcoholism and helped Iron Man out with his. So he's this flawed, good-looking, flawed hero, like a Shaken character. Although Fraction says that he wasn't thinking of Shaken when he created this series, there's a big Shaken influence, the whole idea of celebrity and heroism. You know, it goes all the way back to American Flag. And so I like that aspect of it. And it's also, it's just a good superhero book, too. Like, they're fighting against the Soviet super soldiers. So you have Ursa Major, the giant bear, flying in a jetpack. You know, that's cool stuff. So it's got cool fight scenes, and it makes a good superhero book. Plus, it's got the commentary about the media, and it's a smart, well-written book. And the premise also is that each issue does a talking heads segment where one of the applicants or one of the members of the team is kind of narrating. And so it's not too self-aware, but it does allow the characters to clearly establish themselves, and they each get a spotlight as the overall superhero team is evolving. And that's a really good title. And then he also co-writes Iron Fist, and Iron Fist is probably the best regular monthly comic that Marvel's done in years. It has added a whole level of mythology to Iron Fist. It's made Iron Fist fascinating to me. It's made Iron Fist so fascinating that I went back to read all the older Iron Fist stuff, and I found those more fascinating because of what Fraction and Brubaker are doing now. And so Matt Fraction, those four things, I mean, Casanova, The Order, Iron Fist, and Punisher War Journal, those are really four of my favorite things of the year, and he's responsible for all of them. And I hope he gets more entrenched in the Marvel Universe, because I'd like to see him direct more of the titles. Four titles is a lot for one guy to write anyway, so he's not going to write more. But a lot of those titles are not selling particularly well necessarily. Like The Order probably won't last very long. It's one of Marvel's lower selling titles. I'd like to see them sell better, but I think they probably ultimately won't.
Because you could buy more issues.
I could personally buy more, but I don't think that's going to save it. Unless I buy like 10,000 every month. That would be a lot of money. For $30,000 a month just to keep that
going. You are a big time author now.
I have made hundreds and hundreds of dollars in royalties. Yeah, so Matt Fraction is my best of 2007.
Continuing with our theme of best of 2007, as none of you probably know, I am a gigantic fan of professional wrestling. Yes, I know it's fake. I'm aware of this. I really like it. I watch it all the time, all kinds. And best of 2007 for me is the American Dragon, Bryan Danielson. He's just had a phenomenal year. He came, he missed the first part of the year with a separated shoulder. And he came back in April on a tour in Japan with Noah. And it was just phenomenal from the get-go. The guy is an amazing wrestler. He can do it all. He's technically sound as anybody can be. He can brawl with the best of them. And he just has great matches every time out and is a fantastic storyteller inside the ring. His finishing sequences are amazing. The way he ties one move to the next move to get near fall after near fall and just tell fantastic stories. His matches this year, if you want to see some wrestling, if you were ever a wrestling fan in your life and you can't watch WWE because it's too cartoony or because they don't wrestle or because it's all phony or whatever reason you wouldn't watch it, and I completely understand, go to ROHWrestling.com, pick up ROH Driven, pick up ROH Manhattan Mayhem 2, pick up ROH Live in Tokyo, and just watch Bryan Danielson wrestle. The guy is phenomenal. He's had some of the best matches of the year, like the one against Takeshi Morishima in Manhattan Mayhem 2, where during the match he suffered a detached retina about, I think, 10 minutes in, and then wrestled 15 more minutes with a detached retina and couldn't see out of his eye. His match with Go Shozaki in Live from Tokyo is phenomenal. He has two matches in the Driven DVD, one against Nigel McGuinness, which is amazing, one against Kenta, which is also amazing. He's really, really an amazing storyteller, and gives me so much joy to watch him wrestle. He's the best wrestler going today. He's getting my vote for Most Outstanding in the Observer Awards this year. He's getting my vote for Best Technical Wrestler. And he just can do no wrong in my eyes in terms of inside the ring. He had the three-match series with Austin Aries to close out the year, which is also phenomenal. This weekend, he's wrestling Morishima in their fourth match of the year at the pay-per-view. And I'm sure it'll be great because the guy is just an amazing wrestler. He brings so much realism and believability inside the ring and can play the audience like a fiddle. And when it comes down the stretch, just makes every near fall mean something, makes every move mean something, can build a match like no other going today, and is just one of the really, really bright spots in modern wrestling.
And that's Ricky the Dragon's team.
The American Dragon, Bryan Danielson.
Okay, the American Dragon, Bryan Danielson.
Yes.
Okay.
Mix it,
So that's it for this episode. Music provided by Operation Ivy. Next week's episode will be better.